Brussels, seen from Istanbul, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Residents of Istanbul know what people in Brussels are going through. The Turkish city has been hit by terror attacks of its own in recent months.
At least the response I've seen from Turks is that they're just as devastated for Europe as they are for themselves.
Plus, the suspects behind the Brussels attacks were not working alone.
This is a network of at least several dozen people. Potentially, it's hundreds of people. It's not a lone wolf, and it's not just a couple of disaffected youths.
And Belgians cope with a new reality in a style all their own.
Yeah, we try to keep laughing. We're known for a bizarre sense of humor. Surrealism, it's an art form. We're famous for that.
Those stories, plus New Zealanders vote on a new flag, today on The World. Glad you could be here today. There's a lot to get to, including how to party down in drought-stricken India during a ceremony that requires a lot of water. That's later here on The World. First, though, let's turn to what's happening in the aftermath of those terrible attacks in Belgium. Our friend and correspondent Adeline Sia is in Brussels. Adele, for you, this is a repetition of Paris in November. What are you seeing in Brussels?
The first thing I saw when I was actually in downtown Brussels yesterday was this big square covered with candles and flowers and Belgian flags and people chanting and people giving free hugs, and all that was exactly what was taking place in Paris 4 months ago on Place de la République, where people gathered in solidarity with the victims, the family, and just to be together. In fact, when I spoke to you about this last, I had just returned from a little ceremony at the side of a restaurant. There was a minute of silence to the memory of the victims, and people gathered on the street. And today, I went to a ceremony on Place de la Bourse, a minute of silence in the memory of the victims, and that went on for about 15 minutes. Wow. And this was a packed, large city square. There's a part of me that feels that this is like a horrific Groundhog Day. You know what I mean? It's just like it's a terrible deja vu, definitely.
Yeah. So a lot of eerie, sad similarities. So you said the Place de la Bourse was packed. What about just generally? Are there people walking around the streets?
People are walking around the streets. It's quiet, but, you know, they are tourists. I spoke to a whole family from Finland. I spoke to people from Ireland. It seems that people have not stopped their travel, because here's the thing. I was here in November during the lockdown, the weekend of the lockdown, and, of course, nothing was open, and there were very few people on the streets. And this was that the lockdown was only because of threats. And now there's been this huge catastrophic event, and there is no lockdown. So people have decided, well, I might as well go on with my life. And most people went back to work, I think, a day after. So there were a lot of people even on the Grand Place, this beautiful square that you see on all pictures of Brussels, and this sort of a Renaissance square is beautiful. On this beautiful square, I ran into this woman going back to work. She was a lawyer, and she seemed to be very cheerful. And I asked her how she could keep her spirits up given what's happened. And this is what she had to say.
Yeah, we try to keep laughing. I think it's what we're known for, a bizarre sense of humor. Surrealism, it's an art form, we're famous for that, but it's also a way of life in Belgium, and I think that's why you'll see that this weekend people will be going out to restaurants, people will be having drinks, because it's important, it's who we are, it's part of our culture to do things together and live a good life together as well, and things like these can't stop us.
Yes, and Marco, you know, she was really sincere as she was saying this. You can tell from her voice, and from all the other people that I talked to today at cafes and restaurants, they seem to have that will and spirit, and so you know that they'll be able to get through to this.
Friend and correspondent for The World, Adeline Sia in Brussels. Thanks, Adele. We'll check in tomorrow again.
You're welcome, Marco.
Meanwhile, there's an intense manhunt underway in Belgium. Police are looking for one of the suspects seen in a surveillance photo taken at Brussels airport just moments before the two blasts there on Tuesday. Belgian police don't exactly have a great record when it comes to searching for suspects. It took them 4 months to find Salah Abdeslam, the only surviving suspect from the Paris attacks in November. He was arrested just last week in Brussels. But the police operation to find him was deeply flawed, according to Ryan Heath. He's Politico's senior EU correspondent based in the Belgian capital.
I followed the police around at length during the terror lockdown in Brussels in November, and I was very disturbed by some of the things I saw. For example, there is a law in Belgium where you are not allowed to conduct a raid on a private property between the hours of 9 p.m. and 5 a.m. And in one instance, that appears to have allowed Salah Abdeslam to escape, where he was cornered in a property that the authorities were not allowed to enter into. And knowing this was the case, the authorities then began a series of fake raids one Sunday evening after the lockdown began, where they essentially put innocent people under the impression that they were under an imminent threat in a series of cafes next to the main police station in Brussels. And they did that just a few minutes before 9 p.m. so that they could run with the facade that they'd begun an operation before 9 p.m. when in fact their true targets were never raided until around about an hour later. And then I followed the police around as they attempted to conduct some of those raids, and to watch them zigzag, really without strategy and without a lot of effective coordination, it concerned me greatly. And I watched police wave certain individuals through barriers, individuals who had just loaded up their cars with filled bags that the police hadn't bothered to check. Just a range of suspicious activity. And that is what permeates my general level of concern about how all of this is being handled. It's hard not to describe as Keystone Cop sort of bungling in the aftermath of Paris.
Is there any sense right now that the Belgian government would revisit rules like that?
Yes, they did announce a package in the aftermath of the Paris attacks, making it easier to obtain a warrant in order to enter somebody's house. So not necessarily changing the hours, but making those justices available 24/7. Because another related law is that in the past, you weren't able to get a warrant after 4 p.m. on a Friday. Now, you don't have to necessarily go down the draconian route to acknowledge that terror doesn't sleep, that sometimes bad things happen on weekends and also in the nighttime, and that maybe there needs to be some kind of middle way. And I think that we have seen a number of raids of houses, an increase since November, because they've tried to tweak those laws, and that's a good thing. But at the end of the day, they've been searching houses at a rate of one per day since November in that troubled district of Molenbeek. And it's probably too logistically difficult to say you're going to search every single home, although that was done in Boston. They did lock down whole districts and creatively apply emergency laws after the bombings there. But there is some kind of middle ground between searching one out of 250 homes and searching every single home. And I think what the Belgians haven't done is come up with that sort of short and medium-term strategy to make it legally possible to conduct those operations. And that's why you see frustration at all levels from partners with Belgium, people throwing their hands up in the air, just saying, we don't know how to fix this when the Belgians stay so rigidly on their course.
I mean, the investigators in Brussels didn't find the Paris bomber suspect until several months after the November attacks, and he was just across the border at his mother's home outside of Brussels. What do you think that one story tells us about the problems with security in Belgium?
I think the reality is that while clearly the very large majority of people, even in suburbs like Molenbeek, are peace-loving, law-abiding people, it's not a case that this is just a few stray individuals that are organizing these acts. There are other layers of people involved in the network. So think of it like an onion. You might have the core of people, then you have the others who are now already blown up or those people who are on the run. But you have third and fourth layers who are not too far away from them. The people who organized for them to be transported between these different houses, the people who hid them in their actual houses, the people who helped them make explosives and obtain other ingredients and essential information for coordinating these attacks. This is a network of at least several dozen people. Potentially, it's hundreds of people. It's not a lone wolf, and it's not just a couple of disaffected youths. So there is clearly a much denser sort of set of organization than what the authorities had realized. And that is another reason why we need to really still be on high alert here at the moment. It's not to say another attack will occur, but every time we thought we'd gotten to the bottom of this network, we clearly hadn't. And so that's why it's very possible that more layers are out there.
Ryan Heath, Politico senior EU correspondent, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Here's something else Belgian police missed. One of the suspected suicide bombers in Brussels was detained for possible links to ISIS when he was in Turkey last summer. There are conflicting accounts of exactly what happened next. Reporter Dalia Mortada in Istanbul has been looking into that.
Ibrahim Bakraoui was picked up in the southern province of Antalya. Antalya is this tourist resort town full of European tourists in the summer. And he was picked up in June of 2015. And he was picked up for suspected terror links and for suspected links to ISIS. And because he's a Belgian national, he was deported back to Belgium. Belgium picked him up, said they couldn't find anything on him with links to terrorism, and let him go.
How often does that happen, that ISIS suspects are picked up and deported? Other examples of Belgians, for example?
There are. So in November, we had a big news flash about a week after the Paris attacks, that Turkey had picked up another Belgian national of Moroccan origin for his links to ISIS, and he was picked up with two other guys. Again, he was picked up in Antalya, and Turkey had said, you know, we wouldn't have let him in if Belgian authorities had warned us that he had terror links, but Belgian authorities hadn't. And so I don't know how often this happens. We don't get an alert every time it does happen, but because this was, less than a week after Paris in November, everyone was on high alert. And it was definitely an indication that, you know, perhaps there's something missing here coming from Belgium in terms of intelligence and in terms of counterterrorism efforts.
I got to say, it's kind of terrifying that Turkey picks him up and flags him as a suspected foreign fighter, and then he totally falls through the cracks. And Belgium, when he gets back to Belgium, and Belgium can't find anything on him. And now two ministers in Belgium have offered to resign for this oversight. And Turkey, in the meantime, has been suffering its own wave of terror attacks in recent months. Just remind us what's been happening there.
Basically, since June, we've seen six attacks on civilians in different parts of Turkey. In June, we saw one in the southeastern province of Diyarbakir. Then we saw another one in July that we spoke about on The World against a group of young people who are planning to go to Kobani and help rebuild Kobani. That was linked to ISIS. In October, there was a huge attack in Ankara that killed over 100 people. That was also linked to ISIS. And then in 2016 alone, we had an attack in Istanbul in a tourist district that was linked to ISIS, two attacks in Ankara that were linked to Kurdish militants. And then a week after the latest attack in Ankara, so this past Saturday, one in Istanbul that was linked to ISIS. And for Turks, this isn't something Turkish people are used to, especially in Istanbul and in Ankara. These are vibrant cities, just like, you know, any European or American cities. They're full of civilians, people just going to work and, you know, participating in cultural events, going out at night. This isn't a normal for the people who live here. And so to see four attacks since January alone has been really disheartening for a lot of people that live here. It's definitely, I mean, morale has plummeted. Anyone, I ask my friends, I ask people on the street, you know, how are you feeling? What's going on? And people are just kind of broken and confused. And they feel abandoned, right? They feel like, why isn't our government keeping us safe?
How have Turks been responding to the news about the attacks in Belgium?
They're pretty devastated. I mean, I'm sure you've seen on social media, there are a lot of people saying, oh, you know, every time an attack happens in Europe or on a European city, people have this outpour of support. But then what about Ankara, or what about Istanbul, or what about wherever?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, at least the response I've seen from Turks is that they're just as devastated for Europe as they are for themselves. I mean, of course, they would like to be better understood that Ankara and Istanbul are not places where these things usually happen. That is a misconception probably among the Western world. But for them, you know, for these kinds of attacks to reach Europe, it's very saddening. You know, they don't want innocent people to die like this.
Reporter Dalia Mortada speaking with me from Istanbul. Thank you very much for your time, Dalia.
Thank you, Marco.
Stepsisters who didn't know each other flee their country together. That story coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Imagine having a stepsister you don't know, then meeting that stepsister as you are fleeing your country. That's what happened to the two young women we're going to hear from next. They fled together from Central America and have now won asylum in California. Zadie Stavely has their story.
When Natalia Maya and Monica Cisneros met, they weren't sure they'd ever get along. They seemed too different. Natalie has a piercing in one eyebrow, and she likes to wear all black. She saw Monica as a girly girl.
Porque ella es, como decirlo, más femenina que yo.
Monica is more feminine than I am, says Natalie, and really sensitive.
Yo lloro por cualquier cosa. Yo soy bien llorona.
Yeah, I cry about everything, yeah. Monica says. She also saw Natalie as tougher, more reserved. The girls are stepsisters and now live with their parents in Vallejo, California, near San Francisco. They arrived here from El Salvador, where they lived with different grandparents. They never knew each other there, but they shared this fear of the gangs rampant in El Salvador. Both girls have faced kidnapping threats, so they eventually connected and decided to migrate north together to be with family in California. Leaving was hard.
Los sentimientos pues te matan por dentro. Lo primero que tú piensas es como...
The feelings kill you inside, says Natalie. You think, I've left everyone behind. My family, my friends. It's Monday and you think, I would be at school right now. Or, now I'd be coming home. And the only thing you have are the people traveling with you. The girls took buses through Guatemala and Mexico. They crashed at budget motels.
Había una noche que sí, estaba haciendo mucho frío.
Monica says that one night it was really cold. There weren't any blankets on the bed. They had to pull sheets and towels around each other to keep warm. But the most frightening part was when Mexican police took Monica, and just Monica, off the bus to question her.
Estaba bien cerca de que me regresaran.
Monica says she thought she'd be deported back to El Salvador. The bus then took off, with Natalie still on it. The Mexican officials eventually let Monica go, but she and her stepsister were separated for a night. It was scary to be apart.
Esa noche sí no podía dormir. Me daba miedo todo.
Monica says she was afraid to sleep that night. She'd never been alone before. When the girls reunited in a town the next day, they felt closer than ever. Then, after 2 weeks of buses, the stepsisters reached Texas. Border Patrol agents stopped them, and they were separated again in a detention center. Monica was released first, then Natalie a week later. Natalie remembers landing in California and seeing Monica at the airport. They were together in the U.S. at last.
Iba bajando las escaleras y lo primero que vi fue a Monica.
Natalie says she was coming down the stairs and saw Monica and then her mom. She chokes up talking about it. She hadn't seen her mom in over a decade. She didn't really remember her. The reunion was joyful, but it was hard to get used to it all. Parents they hadn't seen in years, and a little brother born in the U.S. The stepsister's mom, Rosa, remembers how rocky it was.
Fue una guerra grande que hubo al principio.
Rosa says it was a war at first. The girls would explode and yell at her and her husband. Now, 2 years later, they laugh about it. And both of the girls say what kept them going was the friendship they found in each other on their journey to the U.S. At the family's apartment, Monica peeks over Natalie's shoulder while she plays with her phone. Last May, both girls won asylum to stay in the U.S. They go to the same high school and work at the same McDonald's in the afternoons. They still fight sometimes. Natalie says she hates it when Monica borrows her clothes. But still, everything we've gone through, we share it, Natalie says. Living in a new country, going to a new school where they don't speak your language, it helps to have someone, a sister, who knows you and what it took to get here. For The World, Zadie Stavely, Vallejo, California.
Around the time that I discovered soccer as a kid, I went with my dad to Europe for the first time. It was 1974, and the World Cup happened to be in full swing in West Germany. I got to watch several matches on TV, including the final between the West Germans and the Netherlands. It was so exciting because I was seeing a game I barely recognized. I'd never seen any professional soccer, and I myself was playing in a kids' league, so... Now, part of the reason for the unreal kind of athleticism on the field, one of the players, a Dutchman named Johan Cruyff. Cruyff, we have learned, died today. He lost a fight with cancer at the age of 68. I've got the world soccer guy, William Troop, with me. What exactly was I seeing in 74? Why was that game so exciting?
You were watching the game of soccer being torn apart and revolutionized. I mean, nothing short of that. By the way, I was a kid in Italy at the time watching the World Cup on my little black and white television. I watched those games too. truly, it was soccer being played the way I had never seen it been played, the way nobody had seen it played.
And it was because of Cruyff, right?
It was Cruyff. He was a central character in a revolution that became known as total football. The Dutch invented it, but Cruyff was the guy who made it work. And what it was is, before this time, soccer was played in a very rigid, traditional way. A goalie, a line of four defenders, four midfielders, and two strikers or forwards whose job was to kick the ball in. And the idea was just to, you pass it from line to line very rigidly to the forwards and they kick it in. Everybody had a job and a place in the field where they stood. In come the Dutch and Johan Cruyff, and they come up with this concept of any player can go anywhere on the field as long as they go into a space where they're open and free. And Johan Cruyff really was the guy who personified that. He would basically roam around the field. He would be a forward 1 minute, and then he would go all the way back and get the ball way back in the defense. And wherever he got it, he would have this like amazing pass. I mean, he was also a very skilled player, so when he got the ball, he knew what to do with it.
So total football, but for Cruyff and the Dutch, not total victory in 74. Did they ever win the World Cup?
No, and it was crushing. I mean, everybody, the whole world was rooting for the Dutch to win the World Cup. They still haven't won the World Cup, by the way.
Ever.
They had another chance to win the World Cup. They got to the final in 1978. But famously, Johan Cruyff did not go to that World Cup. He refused to go, in fact. It was assumed that it was because he was a really opinionated guy. He wanted things done his way. And so people thought he was clashing with the coach at the time. Later, other stories emerged as to why he didn't go. But the fact remains is the Dutch got to the final, and people think that, you know, if he had been there, they might have won.
So Cruyff is a legend, but can he be considered one of the true greats if he never won the highest trophy in soccer?
Well, he never won the World Cup, true. He won a lot of individual awards himself for best player in the world. He was considered second only to Pelé as far as best players in that whole century. Mm. But what really speaks to how important Cruyff was for the game of soccer is two things. One is, you know, here's a guy, very few people invent something on the field and have it named after them. Johan Cruyff invented this thing called the Cruyff turn, where you fake your opponent that you're going one way and then you bring the ball around your feet and go the other way. That's called the Cruyff turn today. I'm still trying to master it, by the way. But the other thing is, Cruyff brought a philosophy wherever he went of total football, of movement on the field. And guess where he took that? He took that to Barcelona, where today the best team in the world and the best player in the world play, Lionel Messi. They are products of an academy that Cruyff started at Barcelona, where basically kids were taught total football. You know, we're still seeing Cruyff's legacy today on the field.
And that legacy is going to continue. The world's one-man soccer desk, William Troop, thanks for reminding us of the great Johan Cruyff.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's Holi, the Indian festival of spring and color. People cover each other with dye powders, then add water.
Water pistols or super soakers or buckets. And in some places, even rigging up a temporary shower structure in the garden or common areas.
Unless, of course, there's a drought. A dry Holi ahead on the world.
Support for this podcast comes from Wonder Capital. What if you could help combat global climate change and make money at the same time? You can. Introducing Wonder Capital, the leading online investment platform where individuals can invest in large-scale solar projects across the U.S. Earn up to 11% annually while diversifying your portfolio, curbing pollution, and combating climate change. And Wonder Capital doesn't take any fees for investing your money. Join thousands who are already investing. Create an account for free at wondercapital.com/the world. That's Wonder with a U. Wonder Capital. Do well and do good.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A striking photo in the news out of Moscow today. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian President Vladimir Putin shaking hands and smiling. A contrast to some of the hard feelings between the U.S. and Russia in recent years. The two men met for talks about Syria and Ukraine. So does that mean there's a sudden thaw in U.S.-Russian relations?
The words that the Russian press is using to describe Secretary Kerry's visit today is that we are having friendly relations between the United States and Russia. I think that's very inappropriate.
Michael McFaul was the American ambassador to Russia from 2012 to 2014. He says today's Kerry-Putin photo op does not mean Moscow is coming in from the cold.
We should be able to sit down across the table from Mr. Lavrov or Mr. Putin and cooperate when it's in our interests, but have no illusions that we're on to a new period of grand cooperation or detente or reset. Remember, while these negotiations are happening, the Russian press and Russia propaganda are describing us as the evil empire. They're talking about all the bad things we're doing, all the destabilizing things we're doing in Ukraine, in Russia, in Syria. You know, if you watch Russian press, you'll see that we not only invented ISIS, but we continue to support ISIS. That's the people that are on the other side of the table. And having said all that, we want peace in Syria. I believe the Russians want peace in Syria. And eventually, I hope we both want a true political settlement in Syria.
Shouldn't Washington be saying thank you to Moscow, even for allowing this way forward and landing this partial ceasefire we've got right now?
It all depends on what the Obama administration's objectives are. I mean, originally, the objective was a political transition that did not include Assad staying in power. The president himself said that. Today, it seems inconceivable to me that you would have a transition that Assad and his regime would not be a major player in. And, you know, I don't want to prejudge what might happen in Geneva. I want to keep optimistic, but most certainly Mr. Assad believes that he's going to remain in power for a long, long time.
Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic magazine says a senior Obama administration official told him, quote, Kerry is looking like a chump with the Russians because he has no leverage. And according to this version of the story, Kerry would go to Obama asking whether the U.S. could send a message to Assad by launching a few cruise missiles to hit regime targets. And Obama always said no. So given the urgency of settling the conflict in Syria, has Washington really been able to afford to sit back, and can they still?
Secretary Kerry is seeking to negotiate a solution with a weak hand. And it's the Russian Air Force that has created facts on the ground that has strengthened Assad's negotiating position. And, you know, over the years, I was, even when I was still in the government, I was an advocate of us taking greater military force, and in particular, after Mr. Assad used chemical weapons against innocent civilians, we should have, in my view, used military force against him.
Secretary Kerry is also focusing on eastern Ukraine and pressing Russia to get pro-Russian separatists to comply with a ceasefire there. And, of course, he'll want to talk about the case of Nadezhda Savchenko. She's a Ukrainian pilot. She appeared in a Russian courtroom this week, and I'd like us to hear her response in the court to being sentenced to 22 years in prison. So Nadezhda Savchenko there, defiantly singing in court a nationalist Ukrainian folk song. Michael McFaul, remind our listeners of her story.
Well, she was a pilot that was then taken by the Russians and considered a criminal and not treated as a prisoner of war. The entire world has been outraged by the treatment of this woman. And I don't predict any big change in that. I mean, possibly if there's really a sentiment in Moscow that they need to try to diffuse tensions in eastern Ukraine, and in particular for them to create some momentum to lift the sanctions this summer when the European Union will discuss them again, maybe you'll see some kind of swap. But I'm not expecting it anytime soon.
I mean, Washington maintains that the charges against Savchenko are false, and that leads me to wonder, can Moscow and Washington work together on peace in Syria, given how volatile things are in Ukraine? I mean, how will one affect the other?
Well, the Obama administration, and most certainly Secretary Kerry, has decided to pursue a policy of, you know, compartmentalization, which are, or non-linkage.
Can you really separate them?
Absolutely. That's exactly what we're doing now.
Michael McFaul at Stanford University, who was the U.S. ambassador to Russia from 2012 to 2014. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Even before this week's attacks in Brussels, Europe was starting to close the door on refugees. More than 1 million people made their way to Europe last year, most of them going through Turkey first and then Greece. Now thousands who are trying to make their way north are stalled in Greece. European leaders want to send them back under a new migration deal with Turkey. Jacob Resnick has a story of one of those asylum seekers. He's not Syrian. He's an Iraqi, Jacob Met, in the city of Idomeni on the Greek border with Macedonia.
I met Ibrahim Esmail Ibrahim standing on the train platform at Idomeni's train station, though there are no trains running now. He's 26, a Natalie Dress guy from Baghdad. As a teenager, he landed a job with GLS, Global Linguist Solutions. It's a contractor based in Virginia that provided interpreters to the U.S. military during the Iraq War. The pay was good, $1,500 a month plus bonuses. The soldiers liked him and nicknamed him AP. But after 6 months on the job, Ibrahim says his life was threatened by insurgents.
That night, they got me from my shoulder and they told me, "I will cut your head from your body if I see you again here."
His family urged him to leave the country. Before he got out, he emailed his favorite American sergeants to tell them what was going on.
And I tell them what happened with me. He told me, "Okay, then give all your badge number and give it to GLS in Green Zone in Baghdad." I went there, I give them, and then the next day I take bus to Syria.
In Damascus, he found a white-collar job at a telecom company. But he dreamed of someday going to the U.S., where his sister lives. His brother-in-law pointed out that because of his service to the U.S. military in Iraq, he could apply for an SIV, a special immigrant visa for the U.S. But for that, he'd need proof of his employment. So he wrote to GLS, the company with the multi-billion dollar Pentagon contract.
"They don't answer. They don't answer me. They said the contract is closed with the U.S. Army, and you can't get your documents. It's very difficult."
We contacted GLS in Virginia, but we haven't heard back from them. Ibrahim stayed in Syria for a few years. Then he moved to the Kurdish region of northern Iraq, where he worked odd jobs under the table. But being an ethnic Arab there was a problem. He says Kurdish authorities told him to go back to Baghdad, but he was too afraid. So instead, he crossed the border into Turkey, where in 2014 he met an Afghan woman. They got married in a religious service. She was able to get to Canada, but she can't bring him over because they don't have a legal marriage license. For now, he's stuck in Greece.
"I'm alone. My wife in Canada and my sister in America. And my mom and my father, they are in Turkey. After 2 months, they will go to America. My sister, she invites them."
His sister can bring his parents over, but it might take years for him to get permission. So Europe is his destination for now. Human rights officials point out that countries are supposed to weigh individual asylum cases on their own merits. It's a core principle of international law. But with the EU's new deal with Turkey, it's highly unlikely Ibrahim will be allowed to stay. For The World, Jacob Resnick, Idomeni, Greece.
Europe's refugee crisis is extreme right now, but the images are also reminiscent of scenes during the war in Bosnia in the early 1990s. Ethnic cleansing forced huge numbers of people to flee their homes in parts of the former Yugoslavia. A key player in that war was Bosnian Serb political leader Radovan Karadzic. Today he was found guilty of genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes at a court in The Hague. The Guardian's Julian Borger is here to help us make sense of the verdict. Describe the scene in the courtroom today, Julian.
It was obviously very, very somber. There, half the public gallery was taken up by bereaved mothers, survivors, widows from the killings in Bosnia. And they were separated from the court and from Radovan Karadzic himself by this thick, bulletproof glass. So it was all as if in a fishbowl. Karadzic himself sat there impassive for most of the reading of the verdict, only appeared nervous when he got up at the end, his arms stiff by his side, to hear his genocide conviction for Srebrenica and nine other counts of crimes against humanity, war crimes. But then immediately after the judges had left the chamber, he quickly summoned a huddle of his legal advisers and it got on to talking about his appeal, which is going to be filed within the next month. So this saga has still some time to play out.
How did those widows in the courtroom react when they heard the verdict?
Well, when they came out outside the tribunal, their attitude was really very much, you know, a glass half full. They were angry that he didn't get a life sentence, despite convictions for crimes as serious as genocide, the most serious crimes anyone's been convicted of since the Nazi era. And so there was an element of some bitterness that they didn't get everything that they'd expected.
For you, though, Julian, how significant is it that he was found guilty on this charge of genocide in connection with the 95 massacre of thousands of Muslims in Srebrenica?
very significant. I mean, others have been convicted of abetting that genocide in Srebrenica, so it's not the first time we've heard this word, but he was convicted of overseeing and being a leading player in that genocide by creating the conditions, creating the expectation that people, the Muslims, would be driven out of that area. And the judges, in quite a definitive finding, found that he had been directly complicit in the killings, ordering these captive Muslim men and boys to be transferred and referred to them by encode as the goods or the merchandise, to get them transferred to a warehouse where the judges said he knew that they would be executed.
Since you've covered this story for such a long time, you've written a book about the hunt for war crime suspects in the 20 years since. I'm just curious to know what struck you most today when you think about what you saw in the Balkans years ago.
Well, I suppose the old quote of the banality of evil. What struck me most, I suppose, is that for all the historic nature of the judgment, the facts on the ground remain the facts that he created this division of Bosnia into a Serb and Muslim Croat, two halves, and the Serb half remains cleansed, as he had it, of Muslims and Croats. That remains a basic fact about Bosnia today, and it's the basic fact that stops Bosnia developing or moving on.
You just finished the publicity tour for your new book, The Butcher's Trail, about the manhunt for war criminals in the Balkans. Did you find people have forgotten about this chapter? I mean, how do you talk about this tragedy in the Balkans to people who weren't alive when it happened?
It is hard. I think there is some element of denial in that it was a terrible failing on the part of the West not to have intervened earlier to stop this killing right in the middle of Europe. It was a terrible moral failure. And I think there is a desire to look away from that now, and also desire to forget this period of history because of the need to portray the refugees coming from the latest bout of killings in Syria and Iraq as somehow alien. There's a desire for amnesia, to forget that Europeans themselves not long ago were refugees from an equally brutal conflict.
The Guardian's Julian Borger there. He was speaking with us via Skype from the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. That's where former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic was convicted today and sentenced to 40 years in prison. He plans to appeal. A quick update now on a story we've been following for a while. It's about New Zealand's long search for a new flag. Many New Zealanders wanted to ditch the current one with the British Union Jack and colonial overtones. So the government invited people to send in new design proposals, and the public was asked to vote on them. In the end, New Zealanders chose a black and blue flag with a silver fern. But it wasn't over. The fern flag had to go head-to-head with the Union Jack one in a final round of voting. New Zealand's prime minister stumped hard for the fern, and now, after 10 months and millions of dollars spent, we have a winner with 57% of the vote. It's the old flag.
I'm naturally a little bit disappointed that the flag didn't change tonight.
That's New Zealand Prime Minister John Key.
I mean, what you have to say is that people on the final analysis on a majority basis decided that they thought that our history as a British colony and the Union Jack, you know, fitted better and sat better with us than taking a step into, you know, a world where we would have the silver fern.
Supporters of the silver fern think the Prime Minister jinxed it, actually. Here's Lewis Holden from the campaign to change the flag.
It actually seems to have largely been driven by a dislike of the Prime Minister and criticism of the process that was followed to get to the referendum around the design process. So those seem to be the key factors of why we haven't voted to change the flag just now.
Holden thinks this is not the last time New Zealanders will get the chance to switch flags. But what about the time and the expense of it all? Was it really worth it? Lockwood Smith is New Zealand's top diplomat in Britain.
I think it has been worth it because one of the great things has been it's really engaged New Zealanders with, you know, with our identity, you know, with how do we see ourselves? Are we happy with our flag? And I think it's been a really useful process. I've never in my lifetime had New Zealanders talk so much about, you know, our identity, if you like.
So what do you think? After spending all this time and money, did New Zealanders make the right choice? Because the new boss is the same as the old boss. We're hashing this out on our Twitter, at PRI The World. Take a look at the two options and cast your vote. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Today is Holi, the festival that marks the beginning of spring in Indian communities around the world. You've probably seen the pictures, people throwing brightly colored powders and paint at each other, then dousing each other with water. Well, this year, India is in the depths of a bad drought, and that's affecting the celebrations. Reporter Chavi Sachdev celebrated a dry Holi in Mumbai today. She talked me through what people typically do on this day.
People get together in their communities and they greet each other with colored powder, usually in their hands, and make a big mess on each other's faces, rubbing it on each other's cheeks, and then dousing each other with water, either through water pistols or super soakers, buckets, and in some places even rigging up a temporary shower structure in the garden or common areas and having rain dances, if you please.
Just getting wet, but this year, I gather the Indian government has requested people to have a dry Holi to conserve water. Why did they ask that, and are people listening?
So all over the country, we've had a water shortage. The monsoon was not kind to us last year. And in Maharashtra, the state I live in, we've had a very severe drought. There are villages that have absolutely no water to drink. There are crops and fields that are fallow. So our chief minister asked us to have a dry Holi, not to have any rain dances. Water suppliers were banned from taking tankers to anybody who requested them. And there are NGOs and, I believe, vigilantes who've been looking out for any profligate use of water.
What about the police themselves? Did they patrol the streets, kind of water patrol?
I saw a lot of policemen out today, but I assume they're just looking out for rowdies who've had a lot of cannabis, because today is the only day that use of cannabis is sanctioned. But I didn't see any policemen checking whether people were using water.
Right. But as you said, I mean, this drought is pretty serious. In some parts of the country, farmers have killed themselves because of low harvests. What about Mumbai? Is this the first time that people in the city are actually seeing the impact of a drought?
So we've seen this before. I remember in the 80s, there was a time when the water supply was not very reliable and people would fill water in buckets in the morning. And for a vast majority of our slum dwellers, this is their life. They get water only for a few hours. But urban Mumbai has been untouched for the last 20 years. I think now, with water cuts around the corner, people are starting to feel the impact.
So you celebrated Holi as a kid, Chavi. Was it sad to have this celebration be so different than the ones you've known in the past?
I have to confess that I actually really don't like the wet Holi. I don't enjoy being soaked. I hate, like, you're stuck in these wet clothes. You can't sit anywhere. You're dripping this brown gook because all the colors that have been rubbed on you just basically end up as this dirty, muddy brown. I don't enjoy it. Other people love it. So a lot of people are quite disturbed by the directive, but I was perfectly fine. And my friends were very sporting about it.
Now, you said this is the one day India gets to be Colorado. Cannabis is permitted. Tell me about this drink, Tandai. Is it being prepared this year? And is a hallucinatory beverage still fun when you can't kind of throw wet paint?
I think people enjoyed it, yes. I saw it being passed around liberally wherever I was. The way they make it is they take cannabis leaves, crush them, and make a sort of paste out of it, and then mix it in with milk and dry fruit. I'm lactose intolerant, so I can't indulge in it.
Right.
But everybody seemed perfectly happy, even without the water.
I'm sure. Chavi Sachdev, a reporter in Mumbai, still trying to scrub the paint from her dry Holi off of her face. Thanks so much, Chavi.
My pleasure. Have a happy Holi, all of you.
You know when an artist dies and you feel like you are mourning a friend because of the connection you had to their work? That question was tweeted yesterday by Kenyan musician Bill Salenga. Blinky Bill, as he's known wherever he performs around the globe with his group, Just a Band, or as a DJ. Blinky tweeted that after learning of the death of Fife Dog, born Malik Isaac Taylor, one of the founders and key voices of hip-hop pioneers A Tribe Called Quest. Blinky watched them on MTV as a teenager in Nairobi.
It was just very cool to see black people who are American trying to connect with us as Africans. I was very much drawn to their sound and even the aesthetic that they were putting out.
Tell me more about that aesthetic, because a lot of people have been talking about that in the last few days. What was it about Tribe Called Quest that made you want to listen to more?
The music felt catchy, but not in a forced way. You know, there's sometimes when you can tell that people are trying to sell you their music. And then you can also tell people who are just making music because they love it. And I've always felt like Tribe Called Quest had that in them. That, in fact, there's one of the lyrics where Five says, Tribe Called Quest, you know, we're never going pop. Or we're never going to stop. Something to that effect.
Yeah.
I just like it.
I've been listening to Check the Rhyme today. I'd love to know what you think MCs can learn from it.
What Fife brought in the group for me, it felt like it's a nice variation to Q-Tip's voice. It comes in at the right time because Q-Tip's voice is a bit nasal.
Mm-hmm.
And just having him check in whichever song you're listening to, it's like, hey, some fresh stuff. And there's that song. I like him, white, black, Puerto Rican, and Haitian. Name is Five Dog from the Zulu Nation. Whenever I play that song when I'm DJing, everyone knows that lyric and everyone is singing along. I like him brown, yellow, Puerto Rican, and Haitian. Name is Five Dog from the Zulu Nation. Told you in the jam that we could get down. Now let's knock the boots like the group H-Town. You got BBD all on your bedroom. And even if his role, for the most part, was understated, he brought such a unique and fresh vibe into the group that you can never ignore it.
Well, we will go out with Check the Rhyme today. Musician, DJ, and producer Blinky Bill Selenga joining me from Nairobi, speaking with me about the late Fife Dog from A Tribe Called Quest. Blinky, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Peace and love to Fife Dog and his family. I don't get the message, so you got to run the pitch. You're on point Fife. All the time, Tip. You're on point Fife. All the time, Tip. You're on point Fife. All the time, Tip. So then grab the microphone and let your words rip. Now here's a funky introduction of how nice I am. Tell your mother, tell your father, send a telegram. I'm like an energizer because you see I last long. My crew is never ever whack because we stand strong. Now if you say my style is whack, that's where you're dead wrong. I slay that body and El Segundo, then push it along. You'll be a fool to reply the Fife is not the man. Because you know and I know that you on know point all the time. Fife Dog didn't just influence Nairobi's rap scene. He also tapped hip-hop's Caribbean roots and changed the sound of New York-style hip-hop. Our full story plus a playlist of some of our favorite Fife tracks are at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.